Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Josh Ziefel, and we are going to be talking about They'd Rather Be Right by Mark Clifton and Frank Riley, which won the 1955 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So Josh, thank you for joining me.
Glad to be here, Seth.
Yes. And you have chosen one of the more challenging books in some ways.
Yes. Yes. It was actually you that alerted me to that, I think, when I told you I was thinking about it. So
right. Yeah. And that's been one of the things early on when I would get inquiries from people about guesting or if I'd reach out to them, you know, they'd send me a list of five or six books, and it was often the same five or six books, you know, some of the more famous ones. And all along I knew eventually I'm going to have to ask somebody to cover some of the lesser titles or the lesser known or ones that aren't in very high regard. And so I was delighted when They'd Rather Be Right was in your list. And we'll talk a bit about the book in just a little bit, but let's talk about you a little bit.
Okay. Unlike just about all of your guests that I think I've listened to so far, I do not run my own podcast or anything of that sort. I am actually in higher education. I am the dean of a small Christian university outside of Seattle. I'm the dean of our College of Ministry. I'm a Christian minister myself, but I'm a longtime amateur science fiction fan. Nice. I find that there are, in the Christian tradition, we can talk about many different ways that we can understand God's truth through nature, through the scripture. And I think that science fiction has a unique way of revealing truths in a very different kind of way that is helpful for me to process certain things sometimes. So that's kind of my connection to it. And I guess it's very different from kind of the other kind of world that I tend to operate in. So I enjoy the, it's my preferred form of fiction. It really is.
Nice.
I will say a little nerd cred here. I know that you've said on the podcast that you're a fan of Star Trek novels, and that's how you got, or at least you used to be, and that's how you got into all of this. Kind of the same thing for me. Okay. I started reading, the author named James Blish wrote these series of Star Trek episodes. That's the first Star Trek I even watched, really, by reading it.
Okay.
I read the novelizations of all these old Star Trek, the original series episodes, in seventh grade. And then I just got into Star Trek and some of the classic science fiction and all of that along the way.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I live in the Seattle area, but I'm originally and proudly from New Jersey.
Where you're calling into from today.
That's right, yes.
It's funny, those Star Trek novelizations were just like Star Trek 1 and Star Trek 2, right? Even though they weren't the movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The titles of them were a little strange.
My school library only had a few of them, so I would read all the ones that I could find. It was a strange experience to have not seen the episodes, but to only have imagined the episodes by reading them, and then years later to actually watch the episodes. And sometimes I think they were not like I imagined at all.
No, because I think the novelizations are based on the teleplay, not necessarily what was filmed and edited. So, and we did one of the James Blish ones for Take Me to Your Reader when we covered Arena, which is the famous one with the Gorn.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been adapted a couple different times because they actually ended up paying for the rights to a story called Arena, even though the development was basically entirely separate, but they, like their lawyers looked at it and they're like, no, this is actionable. We need to just pay the guy and put his name on it. So.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you said you're a pretty big reader. How many of the Hugo winners have you read?
Well, I know this is a question you ask your guests, so I did add it up. 44 is what I'm at, and kind of a rule follower and a completist, so I've been working on this project for a few years now. And now I've gotten to the point where I know I still have a few classic good ones left, but also some ones that I know nothing about and might be horrible, so I'm trying to ration myself.
Right.
For the next few years,
yes.
As I go through them,
okay, you got to keep a couple of the good ones, the guaranteed ones,
yeah,
so that you don't have to just pound through a bunch of maybe not so great ones.
I've been surprised a few times, but you know,
yeah. I haven't had any experience in doing this project myself where I'm like, oh, that book was just horrible. There's a couple that didn't hit the way I expected them to, but you know, for the most part, there's at least something good out of having the conversation too. So. That's one thing I appreciate about my own podcast.
Absolutely. That's been helpful for me just listening to reliving some of the books, but then also being thinking a little more deeply about some of the things that I hadn't even considered.
Yeah. Well, my number is at 46 now.
Wow. So, okay.
Yeah. So, and that looks a lot better than 12, which is what it was when I started.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's go ahead and talk about, I mean, why did you choose this book? I mean, why was it in that list originally?
Yeah. So probably until maybe about 4 years ago, I had just read class. Every now and then I'd read some classic science fiction because I thought I should do that. And then I figured out about the Hugos at some point. I looked at the list and I said, oh, I've read a fair amount of these. Wouldn't it be fun to read the whole list? And probably early on in that process, maybe I was trying to go chronologically initially, but I picked up They'd Rather Be Right. And I read it. And honestly, having reread it just in preparation for the podcast, there's a lot about it I forgot, to be honest. I even thought that maybe I was reading the wrong book at one point. But I remember there's a central, and we'll talk about this a bunch because it's the only question the book asks, I think. But there's a central kind of idea to the book that I really found as someone who professionally, as a minister, tries to ask probing questions of people all the time. I thought the central question that it was asking was very interesting and insightful. And honestly, that's the only thing I took away from the book. And it kind of stuck with me. And I thought, man, I'd love to talk about this somewhere. And you know, you can't quote classic science fiction in a sermon. People will walk out because they will think, what is this guy talking about? So this is my only opportunity to talk about it. So here I am.
Right. Okay. So let's move into the actual kind of official non-spoiler discussion of the book. And this is where you would give kind of the non-spoiler pitch for it or synopsis.
Yeah. Okay. I thought about this and I tried to be a little clever, but here we go. Okay. A young man and some older scientists are commissioned to create a machine for the government that has surprising results that no one could foresee. Dun, dun, dun. Or could they?
Yes. Right. I like it. It's kind of like, you know, the inside flap of a Twilight Zone novelization or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And the premise of the book kind of is that, right? It's and when you think about what is at the core of this book, there's an AI, right? And AI has certain capabilities that are perhaps beyond what it was intended to do. And then it's a question of, do we want to do that?
Yeah, the initial purpose, and we can talk about this later, the initial purpose for which it was being built has just about nothing to do with what it ends up doing.
Right.
And again, that was one of those things as I was reading it early on, I said, is this the right book? Did I read the right book? Because I hadn't, you know, I hadn't remembered any of the rest of it, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This one was kind of fun because in the time we're living with the social distancing, you know, my library is closed. And so I couldn't just go down there and get a copy of the paperback. I could have ordered a copy of it. But I ended up finding on Amazon, there was a collection of either Mark Clifton or Frank Riley's. I can't remember who it was, but of a bunch of his short fiction. And it said contains They'd Rather Be Right. And so I checked it out and I was worried because the publication history of this book, it was serialized and then it was heavily cut down for a 1958 edition of the book. And so I was worried that the Kindle one was going to be that cut down version. But as far as I can tell, it's the same as I found a scanned version of it on archive.org that says 1953. Okay. And so, 1955. And so I'm hoping that I have read the entire book now.
Yeah, but I think I have too. Yeah, it's one of these. It's one of these few Hugos that goes by two names. It's also known as the Forever Machine. And
right, and the Forever Machine is the edited down version.
Yeah, I got this. They'd Rather Be Right. It's like a science fiction mega pack, $1.99 Kindle book thing, and it was that kind of thing. So
yes,
and it was originally serialized in I think Astounding Science Fiction was the periodical, which was also where Double Star by Heinlein was published. I think the year after, the year before.
Right. Did you, so in that Megapack version, that's the one that I have, it has three parts to it. And the first part, from what I understand, is just sort of connected short stories, like prequel short stories, but they're not actually part of the original book.
You mean part one of They'd Rather Be Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I had done some reading, a little research last night, and it looks like the story about Joe, one of the characters in the book, was actually kind of a separable, like you said, short story. And when I learned that, it makes perfect sense because it only tangentially has to do with the rest of the story. It's like someone glued it on a little bit.
Well, it's just kind of giving a little bit of characterization to one of the key characters in They'd Rather Be Right. Yeah. I didn't end up reading it just because of what I read. And I was like, okay, I'm not going to do any extra reading for this one that I don't have to, because I'm trying to, you know, move on to another one. So at this point, kind of overall thoughts about the book. You've now read it twice, right?
Yes, I've read it twice. And man, I don't know if this is the point at which I should say this, but I don't know that I care to read it again. Okay. There are some things that I think that I've experienced or seen or watched or read in my life. It's enough to have done it and to take a lesson from it. And that's all I need. I look forward to reading Dune again. I haven't read it in years. I look forward to reading some things, but I think I've got what this has to offer, this book. I think that it, but what it does offer is just this powerful kind of question, which a few years ago when I read it, just had some sort of personal, inner psychological, spiritual kind of reflection with me. But now as I read it, I see it very much as a book about even contemporary society and contemporary politics and things of this nature that I think really is a worthwhile thing to digest. What I would say when I think about this book, I'm not an author. I know you've had some authors on the podcast, but if I were an author, it's like I feel bad for this book because I could see it being something much bigger, better than it is, but it's not put together well enough to be great. I think this about movies. Maybe you've seen a movie and you're like, maybe if you think about the Star Wars prequels or something like that, you're like, I could have done this better, you know? And I think this book has a really interesting question. If it was done and put together more artfully and cleverly, it could rise well above what it is right now to be maybe not amongst the top Hugo books, but certainly better than it is.
Yes, I have to agree. I mean, having read it once, I feel like, yeah, I'm good. You know, I didn't pay much for it. So I actually had a credit on my Kindle. So so I didn't pay anything for it.
Exactly.
But, you know, I did feel like it was worthwhile reading. And I think I had one of those experiences like you do if you go to a movie that's being panned by everyone. And so you're going in with the lowest of low expectations. And then you're like, you know what? I was reasonably entertained.
Yeah.
And that was kind of my experience here. It's very 50s. It's very pulp. But like you said, I feel like there's a germ of a good idea in there that's just not very well executed. So.
Yeah. And it's interesting. It won the Hugo anyway.
Yeah. And it's, you know, people throw up their hands and they're like, I don't know how it won that year. I haven't looked at what the competition was for it, but, you know, it's kind of a controversial winner.
You know, I did take a look at the competition and it's one of those years where they didn't list the competition. So it's just by itself. There is no list of competition with it. So I think 53 and 55, they did that. So I'm not sure what else went up against it. I'm not sure what else was published that year, but, Yeah.
I'm looking on the Wikipedia article and I can't see that it doesn't show any of the shortlist. So that's a bummer. So somebody who does know can weigh in on Twitter or something and let me know. So if you had to pull out comps for this book, you know, like people who have read this book might appreciate this one or this seen this movie or that kind of thing, what would you go with?
Yeah. I mean, I thought of three things, I think, when I think about this. I think, like you said, it's very 50s, very mid-century science fiction, very pulpy, I think. I've not read a lot in that genre, but the feeling that I got is that it's very much that. Secondly, I think fans of classic Twilight Zone, I think that it has, for whatever, and classic Twilight Zone borrows from that kind of pulpy world a little bit too. I think classic Twilight Zone, I think there's some portions that are parallel here. And I think probably, again, a mid-century comparison, if you will, sort of like a original series Star Trek episode that leans a little more heavily on the big philosophical question. I think I can see fans of that kind of science fiction portrayal liking this. Yeah. It's so different from much of contemporary science fiction where you have, I don't know, fleshed out characters or detailed plot or pages and pages on end that just tell you what they're telling you instead of showing you what they're telling you, that it's different. Yeah.
Yeah. This is definitely an exercise in tell, don't show, as opposed to the normal guidance. I wrote down a couple comps, and one of them I wrote down is The Demolished Man, which is a much better book.
Yeah.
A much more interesting book, but it's of the same era. Mm-hmm. It uses the term Esper for people with extrasensory perception. So I wouldn't say that if you've read that one, you'll definitely like this one. It's just, there's some common DNA to it. Mm-hmm. The other one that I compared it to is a more contemporary one. I don't remember what year this is from, but it's called The Truth Machine. And in that book, somebody invents, you know, a perfect lie detector. And and because it's so perfect, it begins to permeate society. Because, of course, you know, no one will make a business deal with someone until they've gone through this procedure. Mm-hmm. No one will contract a marriage until they've gone through this procedure. So they know about all the skeletons in people's closets. And so it's kind of the big idea and how it permeates society. Now, this book doesn't do that. It just reminds me of it because there's a machine that has some some impact on the world. So, all right, I think that's enough of that. I'm thinking we ought to go ahead and just get into spoilers.
Let's do it.
Okay. Spoiler time. So, freeform discussion, anything you want to talk about?
Well, let's just talk about that. Let's just jump right into the book's central question, right?
Yes.
Central idea.
Mm-hmm.
They invent this machine for the government, and they're supposed, it's missile guidance or planes or something, you know? Mm-hmm. And they decide, and it's decided that they should try to make it kind of think like the human brain, but, and, you know, there's some different things going on here, but they end up creating a machine that can basically remove all of the weight of the world from you and basically reverse the aging process and make you maybe functionally immortal.
Right.
And so that's the main kind of plot here. And then they put this woman through it who had lived a really rough life. We can talk about her later. She comes through looking young, vivacious. The character describes her as being the most beautiful person they've ever seen. Mm-hmm. Then they put an old proud man through it, a scientist, and it doesn't work. And they find out that it doesn't work because you have to be willing to let go of everything that you are in order to change.
Yes.
I mean, that's, you know, and there's more to it than that, but the book keeps going back on this theme about the way in which society weighs you down. Society controls your opinions, you know, and stifles creativity. And I think that was interesting for a lot of different reasons. But I mean, that is just what I wanted to jump right to. I hope I didn't give away the whole farm by jumping right to that. But that's really the book's central thing. And it hammers that note probably three times too many. But that consistently throughout the book is what it's about.
Right. And the difference is, I mean, it's kind of like, I mean, if you want to put it in Christian theology, right? It's someone who's come to the end of themselves and is willing to surrender, right? I surrender all.
Absolutely. And
then the process works. But to those people who want to keep holding on to their ideals and their, you know, the things that they hold most dear, they can't go through. Have you ever read The Great Divorce from C.S. Lewis?
Okay, confession here. I have not read that one. I've read a number of C.S. Lewis books, but never The Great Divorce.
Okay. So, you know, it's basically like a bus ride to purgatory. And then some people move on from there to heaven. But it's interesting, a couple points in the book where there's someone who's just holding on to this one little negative thing. Like, it's not a big sin that she has. It's something like being negative. I can't remember what it is. But it's just clawing away at her, and it's got its claws in her, and she can't let go of it. And when she ultimately does, then all of a sudden, you know, she takes the express train the rest of the way. But that's what this reminds me of not being able to cast off that precious thing that you're holding on to.
Yeah, and it's not what's interesting is, so to go a little deeper, Mabel is the woman that goes through the machine first, and in classic 1950s sort of illusion, she's a prostitute, but they don't actually say that out loud, you know, and she
had never been considered respectable, it says.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and, you know, they, you know, all sorts of like aspersions that are cast on prostitutes classically and stereotypically are put on her. All that to say is she's in her 60s, I think, and the world has chewed her up and spit her out, you know, and she's just, she's, you know, it's a very much of a male voice writing it, so it describes how unattractive she is and things like that, you know. But
yes,
but she, you know, again, like you said, she had nothing to lose, and she had everything to gain, and so she basically, I mean, I'll talk about this in And I'll talk about it in Christian theological terms, but this is a standard principle across the board. She mm-hmm. needed to die to what she was to be reborn to something else. I mean, that's
right.
You know, and it's a similar principle probably in like an AA or something like this, that you need to be willing to say, I need help, and actually mm-hmm. go and take help. Because if you don't say that, you can't change, you know? And then the scientist that goes through it, he actually does want to get the benefits of this immortality, mm-hmm. but he's so stuck in his ways of thinking that no matter how hard he tries, I think he can't let go, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. And so that brings it back to where the title comes from, right? Where mm-hmm. Joe, is it Joe? It is Joe. Yeah. He's the young man who is an Esper, right? He has extrasensory mm-hmm. Perception.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, ultimately people are going to be given a choice between being immortal, but having to give up all their preconceived notions, or not being immortal. And ultimately they'd rather be right, right? They'd rather be right in their own mind.
Yeah. And he says it like this. I highlighted one of the quotations. He says, I think, gentlemen, you will find that they'd rather be right and die.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's the idea that grabbed me in this book, mm-hmm. Because it's not a particularly religious or theological statement in this book. It's actually a mm-hmm. statement about science and culture and all of these kinds of things. But the principle is portable in a lot of different areas of life. You know, mm-hmm. I'd rather be right than actually be well, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I like the, there's this quote that I wrote down where Bossy sends back an insufficient data message. And it says, it was the old familiar phrase, which even back at Hawksworth, they sometimes viewed with impatience. A human being is seldom bothered with insufficient data. Often the less he has, the more willing he is to give a firm opinion. A man prefers some answer, even a wrong one, to the requirement that he dig deeper and find out the facts. And I thought, you know, that's just like an encapsulation of the Dunning-Kruger effect or any number of, you know, doctors who went to Facebook University, you know, and think that they can question stuff that comes out from the CDC.
Oh, yeah. I mean, as we're recording this, Seth, we're still in the midst of lockdown and a pandemic and everything. Mm-hmm. And and before that, we saw this with politics. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, the book says again somewhere else, and this is, you know, in the 1950s, it says, man generally believes what he prefers to believe. Most yeah. evidence can be twisted to filter through his screen mesh of prejudices and tensions, so it confirms rather than confounds. This idea yeah. that, you know, we want to believe what we want to believe, and forget it if you want to make us believe something else, you know. And so, you know, the way the book talks about it, though, is really interesting because it's this whole sort of, they have this theory of history, if you will, mm-hmm. That human beings sometimes in these great flashes make these advances in society, and then mm-hmm. in this... and create this kind of disequilibrium maybe. And then as things settle to an equilibrium, popular opinion and whatnot slowly stifles all of that until you mm-hmm. descend into a dark age, and then somebody else rises up again and disrupts it. And I think that's kind of what they're looking at here. And mm-hmm. At the end of the book, they're trying to figure out how to disrupt that dark age settling, you know, how to move society up to the next plateau.
Yeah. That reminds me of, there's a quote from near the end of Double Star, the Robert Heinlein one I posted that one recently, mm-hmm. where it says that, you know, mankind will accept a certain amount of change and then they'll push back. Yeah. But the reforms do stay. It's just a kind of a stepwise motion.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. Change is bad. People don't like change. I mean, the idea that you can hook yourself up to a machine that can do some kind of weird psychoanalysis on you and fix everything that's wrong with you, and then, you know, the fat will melt off of you. And I'm kind of glad it didn't describe how all of that happened, because I have to imagine it could have been really messy, because it's not like you can just metabolize all those things and be perfectly fine, right?
Sounds a little messy, doesn't it?
It is. And I wondered, you know, somebody who's described as unattractive as Mabel, you know, she may have been missing teeth. Did they regrow? I'm assuming they did. Did she have mm-hmm. injuries? Did the injuries miraculously heal? You know, would my shoulders be in better shape? Would my knees?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not the kind of book that invites that sort of question.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
I mean, it does say that Bossy can operate on a thousands per second review of her storage units. So,
yeah. Oh, yeah, kilohertz. We should say, too, this is a real mid-century thing, too. The computer or whatever it is named Bossy because it looks like a cow. And apparently, that's a name for a cow. I learned lots of things.
Yeah. Bessie, maybe, but I don't know about Bossy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a funny one. I did notice I wrote down in chapter 12, there's several biblical references, just, you know, outright biblical references, which you don't always get in more modern science fiction. I feel like, you know, people were a little more, you could say something like, pioneers who had not sold the birthright of men, of man's rise to the stars for a mess of security. You know, that's a reference to Esau.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, somebody like me is going to pick that up. You're going to pick that up, but a casual reader might not.
And that's interesting. I think it speaks once again to the kind of cultural location, sort of a sort of moderate Christian-esque veneer on American society in that era that speaks to that. Mm-hmm. I should also say, by the way, I'm a historian. I have a PhD in history, so you'll get this stuff out of me every now and then.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
So I like this quote as well. Bossy was something new. Bossy did not fit into their theory structure. Therefore, Bossy was per se wrong. They would gladly go to their graves, firm and proud to the last expiring breath of how right they were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was listening to NPR, it's a number of years ago now, and if you Google it, you can still find it out there, but they were talking to someone who, I guess, did some research or something about political opinions, and I think what the conversation was, they said, if you know somebody that has a political opinion and you show them incontrovertible evidence that they are incorrect on this one opinion, maybe it's an economic principle or something or whatever, instead of being convinced like we all think we would be when confronted with evidence, the people actually double down on their original opinion instead of bowing to the evidence.
It's a backfire effect.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I've thought about this a lot. And you know, we see it once again here in this kind of mode in this novel. Yeah.
Yeah. To me, so when you said there was a central idea, you know, that you found here, I was looking to see if I could find, you know, what it might be. And one of the things that I wrote down was scientific orthodoxy. And that's kind of, it goes with that quote that I just read, because there's a lot made in the book about people trusting in science, almost like with a religious fervor. And I don't know. I mean, I get that to some extent because I can see it. I'm not a student of the history of science, but it's one of the topics that I like reading about.
Yeah.
And, you know, I read a book a while back called The Trouble with Physics by Lee Smolin. And it was all about string theory and the development of string theory and how it's gotten to the point that avenues other than string theory for grand unification, you can't get funding for that research because all the eggs are in the string theory basket.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a kind of a scientific orthodoxy where they're like, no, this is the direction that we have to go in order to do this. And we're not going to fund any efforts in different directions, even though that's how science works. Right. And so it's like, it's stifling scientific creativity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think thinking about the 1950s and the United States, when this book, and there's little echoes of that in the background. I mean, I think the book is actually set in the 80s, but it was written in the 50s. At one point they talk about 40 years ago when we invented the nuclear bomb, but in the 50s, when this book comes about, you know, this is sort of a post-war America, McCarthyism, Cold War, you know, everybody needs to keep in line. You know, we're working together. There's this kind of like American unity under a veneer of Judeo-Christian values and anti-communism and all these kinds of things. And I think you can see this coming out of that era of conformity, kind of pushing back against it and almost maybe pushing into that beatnik or early sort of hippie sort of, you know, pushback, which is not about science necessarily, but it is about breaking out of inherited conformities that are seen as constricting or constraining.
Yeah. Good stuff. I love that. So Joe can read people's minds. He can, he can push people's minds a little bit. So then when Mabel comes out of Bossy and she is all improved, of course, she now has this ability.
But what
she doesn't have is the years and years of being able to shield herself from the masses of other people's thoughts that Joe has. And so that kind of draws them together, and he begins to try to teach her those things. And so then when they improve the process, when Carney goes through it, who's Mabel's friend, longtime friend, you know, he kind of comes out with an advanced kind of style of ESP, where he's not as vulnerable as Mabel was. But I liked when they were walking around and peering into people's minds after the announcement of Bossy, and after, you know, people asking, well, who should have access to this? Who should be able to use this? And there was the several times repeated, well, you know, only about 5% of people are really worthy of this. And I'm so fortunate that I'm one of the 5%. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me from a biblical thing of the Pharisee and the publican. The tax collector and the Pharisee, you know, where the Pharisee is justifying himself and thinking,
I am not like,
exactly. And so I wrote down another quote here. Everyone recognized that only 5% of all people born ever amount to anything at all. Everyone humbly thanked his providential stars that through his own personal efforts and merit, he had become one of the superior 5%. Everyone looked with pity and contempt upon the 95% who did not share his grace.
I like that because it's a thing. I mean, it feels true enough. And we like to think, well, and I am, and Seth, you and I are amongst the 5% that can see that truth, you know?
Right. Yes, absolutely.
You know, we don't want to admit it, but we think we are in that 5%, you know, mm-hmm. whatever that category might be.
It's like when you hear the quote, 80% of people describe themselves as above average drivers. Like, that's not how math works.
That is not how my wife describes my driving, but that's a whole other story.
Yes. Yeah. But you haven't been given the grace to drive the way she does. So.
Well, you know, I haven't. Should we talk about Joe a little bit? We haven't really talked about that first story.
Fire away.
I mean, if that's okay.
Go for it.
What's interesting is I think that the first part of the three-part series may actually be a separable story, the story of this guy Joe. And it starts when he's a little kid. He clearly has ESP ability, and his parents take him to the local university. What's interesting, Seth, is the author is playing with that theme of conformity even there, because there's two professors. There's the assistant, the young guy, who really believes he can have ESP. And then his boss, the senior professor, the dean or whatever, says, no way. That's not possible. That's not going to be the case, and just wouldn't accept it or believe it. And the assistant actually had to go around his boss to get this to get Joe the help he needed to get to university later on. So
That reminds me of the Planet of the Apes, where Taylor is talking about how he flew, you know, from Earth to here, and Cornelius says flight is a scientific impossibility. And so as he continues ranting, Taylor folds up a piece of paper and throws it across the room as a paper airplane.
I can't help but think of the Simpsons episode where they do the Planet of the Apes musical. When you say that, you know.
Dr. Zaius, Dr. Zaius.
I can sing. Yeah,
I'm with you.
Yeah. There's this interesting moment, too, where in the second part of the book, these two scientists, Billings and Hoskins, and a team are working with Joe to build Bossy. And news gets out about it, and like a mob with almost pitchforks and torches comes and wants to destroy the thing. And they talk about how there's this witchcraft impulse in people to want to like call things witchcraft that they don't understand, or that kind of disrupt these orthodoxies, if you will, whatever it might be. I mean, it's basically a mob with pitchforks almost.
Yeah. Well, and that's where the actual book begins. At least as far as I can tell, the edition that I got, the way it started was with them in hiding, right? They were like in a flop house.
Yeah. In San Francisco. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Maybe we had a slightly different version, because in my book, it began with the story of Joe when he was a kid.
No. So I have that. It's just in my kind of research about it, I found that was like a connected short story, but wasn't part of the original novel.
Okay. I did not know that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. Now that you're saying it, now I feel like I need to read that just to... So I can guarantee that I've actually read this book.
I'll be honest, that part one is a much better story by itself than the whole rest of it. So you can see how it could be a nice condensed short story. It's actually pretty interesting. So
okay, nice.
I've spoiled all of it now, though.
It's okay. I mean, so you know, like you said at the top, if you describing the plot of this book is easy. Right? They have this machine. You can use it to become effectively immortal as long as you're willing to give up all of your prejudices and kind of move into almost a post-human existence.
Yeah, I think so.
And, you know, they're on the run. Then they do a demonstration of it. It's, you know, Mabel ends up running off naked and getting arrested.
Yeah.
And seen by a psychologist who exhibits this very tunnel vision, you know, with the blinders on. Yeah. Well, this person's clearly crazy. Nothing that she's saying can be correct. Yeah. And yeah, he was kind of a fun character. He reminded me of the psychologist in The Terminator, who just couldn't accept that Kyle Reese was telling the truth. You know, I could make a career out of this guy. And that's what he thinks about Mabel, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, they try it on another person, it doesn't work. They try it on someone else, it does work. And then they have kind of the keep watching the skies moment from the end of The Thing, the original one, where Joe goes on television and says, here it is. You know, we're mass producing it. Everybody can use it. It's yours. And then the curtain drops.
Yeah. And I thought that, I wonder if the author, and by the way, this is weird. Is this the only Hugo book written by two authors in the whole? I feel like it may be.
It may be.
I don't know how that worked. I mean, they're both passed away now, but I mean, how did they co-write this together? How did this work out? Like,
yeah, I don't know. I get the impression that it was mostly Frank Riley, or maybe it was mostly Clifton. Now I can't remember. Let me look at my book here.
Riley, Wikipedia tells me that Riley was a travel columnist for the Los Angeles Times. I think he wrote some science fiction on the side. Mm-hmm. And then Clifton was a science fiction writer as well. So the fact that it's written by two people is very interesting. And I'd just be interested in how that works. As I said, I'm not an author, and I wonder if you have to credit someone, if at least they put in 10% of the ideas or something like that.
Right.
Like, I can imagine this was maybe born out of a conversation, and then maybe one guy helped him edit or something like that, you know.
I wonder. I don't see anything in the Wikipedia article to suggest how exactly it happened.
Yeah.
That they collaborated on it.
I think at the end of the book, what's interesting, what the authors did is I think they were trying to underline their core theme one last time by having Joe decide to mass produce the thing, which maybe they were trying to say, here's a solution no one had thought of. And here now is the solution to do the one thing no one thought of, give it to everyone. Right.
Democratize.
As if to say, once again, I bet reader, you didn't think this was the answer, but it is, you know, that kind of thing.
I have expected to find out that when they tried to replicate Bossy, that it wouldn't work.
Oh,
and that it would be like the robot in iRobot that has the mind reading ability that, you know, we don't know exactly how we did this, but we created a robot with that capability.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we didn't get that.
That is not the direction they went. You know?
No, it's not. You know, I recently listened to Astounding by Alec Neville Lee. Okay. Which is a fantastic book, and it's all about the golden age of science fiction, and it's kind of a biography of Astounding the magazine.
Okay.
High recommend. It's terrific.
Okay. I'm going to add it to my Amazon cart as we speak.
Yeah. And he, you know, kind of connects it to Asimov and John W. Campbell. Well, John W. Campbell in particular, right? Because he was the editor, and Asimov and L. Ron Hubbard and Robert Heinlein. Right.
Yeah.
But there's a lot in there about John W. Campbell's attachment to Scientology and how much he was really into Dianetics.
Yes.
And it made me wonder a little bit here if Bossy's therapy was some kind of, what do they call it? Auditing.
Going clear, you know, all of this. Yeah.
Yeah. I wondered about that. And I'm seeing here on the Wikipedia page, it says that there are conspiracies that attribute They'd Rather Be Right's win to Scientology.
Yeah. Yeah. And I saw that too on the Wikipedia page. I mean, the tricky thing, right? It's like Roswell, the Kennedy assassination, Freemasons, and Scientology. I don't think we're ever going to get to the bottom of what's going on there.
Right.
You know, it's like if I just given up figuring out what happens in any of those arenas. But I mean, I've never read any L. Ron Hubbard.
No, I haven't either.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but the movie Battlefield Earth Accepted, which I've also never seen, he wasn't the worst science fiction writer in the world when he was writing science fiction, I think his reputation is. He never won a Hugo, was a top person, but it was considered a workaday science fiction author at least. So it may be that this book is maybe going back to your question earlier, this may actually be similar to maybe some of his fiction. Again, I'm just guessing, but knowing what little I know about Scientology and that auditing and the machine and it does seem a lot like it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I tend to be an anti-conspiracy theorist though, so
Me too.
It would take a lot for me to believe that there was this vast conspiracy to give this the win.
Yep. Yeah. That's when I look at, like, you know, flat earther arguments, I'm like, do you have any idea the scale of the conspiracy that would be needed?
They'd rather be right, Seth. They'd rather be right.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. No, we're not saying that this book predicted the flat earth movement, but
no.
I think the internet made it inevitable though.
Yeah. Yeah. At the beginning of the pandemic, I forget who it is, maybe a New York Times columnist said, boy, this is really not the time for us to be having an argument about the nature of truth in society right now. Really, is it?
Right.
And we've seen that borne out in the midst of everything. So,
yep.
Yeah.
Definitely. Well, I have come to the end of my notes.
Okay. Let me see if I have anything else that I'd like to add here.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, if that's okay. I mean, I don't.
Yeah.
I've listened to so many of your podcasts at this point that I know the next question you're going to ask. So I just leap past it sometime. Mm-hmm. You're like, now, before we go, do you have anything, final thoughts you'd like to add or something like that?
And yep. Pretty much.
Yeah, exactly. So I think I just like to loop back to this, and I realize this is not a theology podcast in any way. This is not a Christian podcast in by any means, but this is where I am, you know, and in classic postmodern fashion, I'll speak from my viewpoint.
Sure.
But I do think, as someone who is a religious person and a religious leader, I mean, I've been a minister, I've preached a sermon, which is like a, you know, which is kind of like a religious TED talk, or a TED talk is a secular sermon, or whatever it might be. I really value, I mean, when ministers preach, they preach for all sorts of different reasons. I mean, some people, unfortunately, just want to guilt people or browbeat people. For some people, it's just teaching content. For other people, it tends to be variations on just one theme of a general message. And all these have different examples in history. When I get a chance to speak before an audience, and you know, when you speak before an audience, people are in all different places, I like to always ask good questions. I like to try to leave people with something where they say, huh, hadn't thought of it that way. Not sure what I think, but I might think about this later this week, and maybe it might, you know, like that piece of sand in the oyster. And that's what stuck with me from this book all these couple years later, you know, this kind of question. Would I rather be right, or would I be willing to die to my received opinions and move forward? There's another quotation right at the end of the book, right, that Joe says, he's talking about Bossy, and he says, she, Bossy, this computer or whatever, is a challenge to your willingness to admit that you might not be right, that you might not already have all the answers. She is your challenge to your willingness to learn rather than to argue. And my mind goes to something that Bono, lead singer of U2, said in a book I was reading once about a song that he sang called Do You Feel Loved? And it has a question mark at the end. And he said, man, what a job I have. I get to sing to tens of thousands of people and ask them if they feel loved, and then have them maybe think about that. And I think for me, the kind of good question that this asks that kind of sticks with me and should stick with all of us all the time, whatever the context, would I rather keep going and thinking what I'm thinking and be right, or would I be open to change? And as they say in my tradition, that'll preach. And it won't just preach in a church either. That'll preach in the business world. You know, talk about new paradigms. That'll preach in the scientific world, in our political world, and all sorts of structures. Because so if there's one thing, I guess, that sticks with me from this, it's kind of it's as I've said a bunch of times now, it's that. And I think it's important. I think it's an important one of the important things that this book provides.
Yes. Well, and I think that's a good example, too, of, you know, speaking as a Christian, I hear a lot of kind of stereotypes of, quote, Christian thinking, you know, that basically we have all the answers. You don't have to think about anything. And that has not been my experience as a Christian.
Yeah.
I haven't closed down any avenues of thinking about things. I haven't stopped questioning. I haven't gotten to a point where I'm entirely certain about much at all, really. I'm comfortable with having the questions and, you know, answering them one day at a time.
Yeah. And I mean, in my role as an educator too, I mean, that's what we want students. We want students to be asking these tough questions, wrestling with them, you know, and I think that, I mean, just in the same way that I would want a person of no faith to keep asking tough questions and wrestling with the ultimate questions of life, I expect the same from myself, to be asking those tough questions and wrestling with those. So yeah, I think it's maybe the book's only major contribution, yeah. But it's a solid one.
Yeah, yeah. I was curious. I wrote this down as you were talking, kind of there at the end. Bossy, the nature of Bossy is they've only fed in facts, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious, like if you or I wanted to submit ourselves to this, is it going to try and beat faith out of you because it's not verifiable by Bossy? And I don't know.
Yeah, I mean that's something I was thinking about actually. I mean, cards on the table. I mean, mm-hmm. I would rather be right about my religious convictions because I really mm-hmm. believe know they are true. And you know, and the question you can go down this road and say what would it take for me to maybe not to change a strongly held religious belief or opinion? Mm-hmm. What would that mean? I mean, the book doesn't play with that too much. I mean, certain science fiction authors, I think Arthur C. Clarke, maybe Asimov to maybe a little less level, see religion just as a social mass psychology mm-hmm. tool, you know?
I think that question would have been answered by Clarke.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Maybe the era didn't allow it quite as much as it would later in the 60s and 70s mm-hmm. and beyond. But yeah, that does raise a question. Like, you know, would you put a Christian minister or strong believer, like a Christian believer or strong Muslim believer or whatever mm-hmm. religious belief through this system, would it want to take that out of them? You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. I think the questions are worth discussing. Whether or not the book is worth reading or rereading, that's a different question. And I think we'll leave that to the listener.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would like to say this to you. If you're a completist, obviously you're going to read this, but the book does have, it's a good example, I think, if you're looking to see what an earlier era of science fiction is thinking. And also, it's not, even though it's clumsily written, it has some sophisticated ideas. It's not just ray guns and rescuing princesses and all this kind of thing. It asks some really deep questions that I think, or a deep question at least, that I think shows that whatever that early area of science fiction that I think can get caricatured sometimes as there's some depth here that I think.
Yeah. I will say it's not real high on entertainment value. It does have some interesting philosophical things, but you know, it's not, like you said, it's not pulpy, like something like, you know, the John Carter of Mars series, which is a ton of fun. But with not much weight to it, this has a little bit. And like we said at the beginning, it's got a germ of some good ideas in it that aren't really, really well developed, but you know, it's not completely devoid of merit.
Oh, you know, I thought of another comparison, Seth. Maybe this is one of my last thoughts. What is the Arthur C. Clarke book or novel or short story? They just made a movie of it on Sci-Fi. It's Childhood's End.
Yes.
Maybe it's similar in some ways to Childhood End. I've only read it. I've not seen the miniseries or whatever, but.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely some things in there and kind of what we were talking about the kind of the end of faith, right? Mm-hmm. Because the overlords come down and they answer all our questions and they say, your religions are all garbage. You should all give them up, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you want to hear more of my thoughts on that, I did appear on Spectology a while back talking about that book.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I'd be interested in that because, man, that's one of the great reveals in all of science fiction, right?
Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah. It's a very good book. It was one of my dad's favorites. And, you know, my dad was a man of deep faith. And, you know, the fact that Clarke didn't change the fact that he really enjoyed that book and the questions that it brought up.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Cool. Okay. Well, I think that suffices for final thoughts. I think we've been doing final thoughts for like 10 minutes.
Well, we kind of started off with here's the one thought, and then here's some more thoughts about that thought, and now here's the final thoughts.
Right. The final thoughts about that thought. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So, Josh, where can people find you if they want to talk
to you? Well, as I said, I'm not a podcaster, but I do have a largely defunct blog now. I haven't written on it in a couple of years, but it's joshuazeifel.wordpress.com. I will tend to blog there on a combination of history, theology, science fiction, kind of whatever I'm thinking about.
Okay.
My most recent post was a few years ago, and it's called "The Conversion of Han Solo." So there you are. And other than that, I think I'm J.R. Zeifel on Twitter, and I've written a few academic things that are out there floating on the internet. There aren't a lot of Joshua Zeifels, so you can pretty much Google me and find me.
Sounds good. Well, I'll make sure to get any links from you. Mm-hmm. And I'll try and find that you had mentioned the backfire effect. I mean, that's something that I've read about.
Yeah.
I'll see if I can find a good description of that and put that in the show notes as well.
So, great.
Cool. Well, Josh, I really want to thank you for doing this and, you know, taking one for the team and covering this title with me.
Well, if you need somebody else to read one you don't want to, I'll come back, I promise.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll try and hold one of the nicer ones for you instead.
That's good.
I'm pretty full up on guests for the rest of the year. So
That's good.
I've actually, prior to recording this episode, I've actually posted two episodes this month. So, because I've got a little bit of a backlog because I was planning on taking a long sabbatical trip. And then we're like, you know what? I'm going to take the sabbatical and just spend time with my son. But that gives me a little more time for reading now that I've figured out how to read. And so I've just started editing those backlog episodes and I'm going to release them. So I have a slightly faster cadence for the next couple of months until I go back to work.
That's good. That's good. Yeah.
Cool. Well, yeah, again, thank you for doing this. And I'm sure we'll correspond in some way and we'll see about getting you back on later on to help me mop up the final titles. All right. Bye. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Josh. I hope you got something out of that discussion because, you know, talking about a book that is widely considered one of the worst Hugo winners, you know, I have to hope that the conversation is worth the effort of reading the book if my listeners have done that. So I hope you appreciated that. If you would like to support this podcast, you can do that at patreon.com/Hugo's Podcast. And I just want to give a brief shout out to Michael Sinshauser and Roger Anderson and Mitch Wagner and Malk Foy and Alan Ricks and Brian Kozer and Joe Herbers, who support this podcast. Really, really appreciate it, guys. It's fantastic to have you on board. I'm getting really close to the threshold of having to start doing some bonus content. So I'm talking with my patrons about what they would like to see. So we'll see what happens there. And if you would like to chip in, you can do that. I have been posting extra episodes because I have a bit of a backlog, like I mentioned on the previous one. So expect to see about two of these a month for the foreseeable future. I'll probably go back to doing it only once a month once I'm back at work. But until then, you know, enjoy the extra content. And if you would like to support the show in a non-monetary way, if you can retweet the link that I tweet out, share it on Facebook, leave us a review in iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play or Spotify, that'd be fantastic. So thank you so much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.